next case is United States against Frazier. Mr. Hamernick.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Jared Hamernick for Matthew Frazier. I'm going to do my best to reserve about 2 minutes for rebuttal. And subject to the court's questions, I intend to focus my time on the first issue in this case. When Mr. Frazier told the judge that he was seeing about 100 dead people in the courtroom and confirmed that his medication had recently changed, and then also said that those voices were getting in the way of his ability to understand what was going on, he also confirmed that those voices wanted him to hurt people, there was reasonable cause to believe that Mr. Frazier may be mentally incompetent. Because there was reasonable cause, Section 4241A required the judge to inquire sua sponte into Mr. Frazier's competence. Because the judge didn't do that, we think the judge abused his discretion.
But didn't the prior competency determination recognize that he had ongoing auditory visual hallucinations, but conclude that the symptoms did not appear to be impacting his ability to understand and rationally apply facts that were related to the legal process in his case? And I mean, were there any other indications that he was not competent at the time of his trial and sentencing? Or, you know, or is the only reason to question it, his competency, that is, the statement regarding his auditory and visual hallucinations at the waiver of the jury trial?
So that's right. We are focusing on, we have focused this appeal on the jury waiver hearing, the morning of April 9th, 2024, when he had this conversation about these violent hallucinations. So we're not saying that there's something in the record at trial or at sentencing that independently gives rise to reasonable cause. We think it's this hearing combined with the other objective indications of potential incompetence that exists in the record. Coming to your specific question, Judge Roedner, yes, there was this year-old competency finding. We think it's expressly contingent, and it uses words like he's currently competent, he was competent at the time, his symptoms were well managed by medication. But that medication had changed, and we know it had changed recently at the time of the jury waiver hearing because he said so. And it's true that he had these auditory and visual hallucinations even a year prior, but there is this obvious escalation, or at least an escalation that seems obvious to us, in the symptomology. He now is being told by these hallucinations to hurt other people. We think that's an escalation that, combined with his prior finding of incompetency, his long history of mental health problems, and
the district court recognized the gravity of what it had on its hands in front of it. I mean, everything that you're saying, and you've done a good job in your brief, is super serious, but the district court really caught that.
Yeah,
did it not?
No doubt.
Yeah, and so the district court was aware of this obligation, was aware of what he was being told, the district judge in the courtroom, and you're right that it's extreme, it's serious. You'd have serious questions about competency if a defendant was telling you things like that in the courtroom. But the district court was the one that really understood that. So what I have a difficult time with is, where's the error here?
Sure. So the legal error is skipping to step two of the 4241A process, right? So there are serious concerns. I think we can all agree on that. And that's what, under 4241A, triggers the evaluation and the hearing, right? So the bottom line finding of competency, which is what the one I think the judge made, that the legal error was skipping to step two of the 4241 analysis without getting evidence and experts involved, right? The point of the hearing is to determine.
But wasn't the district court mindful of the road that everything had traveled?
Yes, absolutely. But I think what the judge did not take into account was the escalation and symptomology of at this hearing, right? So he certainly grappled with it, and the conclusion was that he's competent. But that's not the question the statute directs the court to ask in the first place. The first question is there reasonable cause to believe that he might not be? If there is, you get evidence and experts involved, and then Mr. Frazier may or may not be able to prove his actual incompetency, but he doesn't have to prove actual incompetency to get a competency hearing. And so the legal error is in skipping to step two of this 4241 analysis.
So we shouldn't take into consideration the fact that his attorney, who had sought the first competency hearing, believed that his decision making was at the same level as when the prior competency determination was made, and believed him competent, and believed that he understood what he was waiving. Of course, he himself indicated that his mental health was the same as it had been. And I really commend Judge Leidy in every possible way for the way he questioned him, you know, having him explain the concepts in his own words. So he was ensuring that he wasn't simply responding rotely and exploring the legal rationale, you know, for the waiver. So, yeah.
So that's right. What I hear in your question is, how can it be an abuse of discretion if his own attorney didn't ask for a competency evaluation, even though the attorney previously had? If I've misunderstood your question, please correct me.
Well, plus how carefully the judge was.
Certainly.
In trying to make certain.
Yeah, so I think that's right. So let me take the second part first, which is, there's no doubt that Judge Lichty was careful in this case. I don't have any dispute with that. I think the difficulty is that, you know, in cases like Graves, this court has said you can't just sort of skip past reasonable cause if you think there are other countervailing indicators, if there are other things to think, well, maybe he is competent, maybe he's not competent. That's why you need the hearing. That's why you go, that's why the statute sets out this two-part process.
You're basically saying, my words, not yours, but I hear you to be saying, given the extreme nature of what the defendant was reporting, seeing in the courtroom, there had to be a bookmark put on the proceedings. We had to have a fresh, present tense inquiry into his competency. And then and only then can we go for, that's your argument.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That is the argument. And to the extent that—
Can you help me out on this business about, I've been confused about this whole medication business.
Sure.
Okay. You make the argument, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, that the defendant was of the view that his hallucinations worsened or something, intensified because he changed medications?
So it's not clear to me, actually, whether they worsened because of the change or because they're just in this sort of, you know, ramp up period on a new drug, right? These are some of the most—
Is it the new drug being Zyprexa?
I believe that's right, yeah.
Okay, yeah. And the old drug being Invega?
Yes.
Okay, what do you understand the argument to be as you stand there right now?
Right, so I understand what the argument to be. A change in psychotropic medication is something that has profound effects on the brain and can cause, either in the interim or because of a worse reaction to the new drug, can cause worse symptoms. So I don't think that we know based on this record whether—
Okay, and is it your understanding that defense counsel, it wouldn't be the defendant himself, I don't think, but maybe it was, the defense counsel said, hey, judge, there's a change of drugs here that could account for the change from last year to this year.
Sure. So defense counsel didn't make that point below. Mr. Frazier himself actually pointed this out to the judge that he had, I believe the testimony was, a few weeks prior, he had changed the drugs that he was taking, that the Zyprexa was no longer available. That's what the jail's pharmacist told him. And so he had recently undergone a change in the drugs. We don't know exactly what impact that had, but I think, again, that's why the evaluation and the hearing is necessary to ferret out that sort of evidence. Seeing that we've got about a minute left, if you don't mind.
If we can give Mr. Hammernick that extra minute, I do have a question. I don't want to take up his time, but I do have a question.
It's your time.
Not mine. Thank you. Can the supervised release condition—
Counsel, if you would face the bench, you will also be facing Judge Rovner. She is not physically in that screen.
I apologize.
I will be next time. Can the supervised release condition be satisfied by 10 hours of community service weekly? Is there any indication in the record that the district court believed Frazier to be incapable of that level of organized activity?
Not to my knowledge. I don't think there's anything in the record where the court or the district judge said, hey, you know what, I'm giving you a 30-hour per week full-time employment requirement, but short of that, do 10 hours a week of community service. I think that sort of clarification by the judge would have justified this sort that condition, but there's no finding along those lines. So, you know, we think that this basically is an exceptionless full-time employment condition. And yes, buried within it, you have what looks to be a backstop of a community service requirement. If the judge really meant to impose a community service requirement, we would just ask for a remand so the judge could clarify that. But a full-time work requirement, we think, is plainly inappropriate given the court's repeated findings that he can't work.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Whalen.
May it please the court. Thank you, Your Honors. Nathaniel Whalen here on behalf of the United States of America. The district court did not abuse its discretion by failing to sua sponte order a second competency evaluation, nor did it plainly err in imposing the condition of supervision that's challenged on appeal, and so we ask you affirm his conviction and sentence. I think Your Honors have hit the nail largely on the head here. What we have is a situation where a defendant went for a competency evaluation, and he said during those times that he's hearing voices, seeing people that aren't there. He says that on multiple occasions in the competency evaluation. And in spite of that, the two doctors at the MCC determined that he was competent. This is a very different case if that competency evaluation never takes place. Because what Judge Lichty also says during the waiver of the jury trial colloquy is that he has that report literally sitting with him on the bench while he's reviewing this waiver. He's well aware of its findings. And so he understood that this is a static condition that the defendant appears to be under, that he is hearing voices. And Judge Rovner, to your point, he doesn't just accept it, right? He doesn't say that, yes, you're hearing voices. And
Judge Rovner is not in the screen. Face the camera.
I apologize, Your Honor. He does not at any point say that just because he's hearing voices, that's the end of the analysis. What he does is he engages in a lengthy colloquy where he asks the defendant over and over again questions to ensure the defendant's competency. And he does ask the defendant, have you changed medication? Judge Scudder, to your point, so on page 5 of the colloquy, he says that he's no longer taking Seroquel. Seroquel was the one he took during the MCC evaluation, and that's on page 10 of the psych eval report. On page 5 of the colloquy, he says he can't get Seroquel anymore. Instead, what he gets is something called Zyprexa. They're both dealing with mental health illnesses like schizophrenia, manic behavior, bipolar behavior. That's the switch. But what he also says is, yeah, and I was also hearing voices when I was on the prior one, and that wasn't working either. So even though there is a change in the medication, what we have is the same symptoms that are in front of Judge Lichty as he's undergoing this evaluation as previously existed at the MCC. What the court did is what this court's told this district court judges to do and engage in this colloquy. He asked Mr. Frazier to define a jury, or he didn't ask, Mr. Frazier voluntarily defined a jury for the district court. He defined what unanimous meant. He told the court he understood concepts of jury trial and sentencing and a waiver of a jury trial. He stopped and he asked questions when he didn't know the answer to things. He consulted with defense counsel. And yes, he had a mental illness. I don't think that's a dispute at this point. But mental illness is different than incompetency. And the competency had already been evaluated. There's no reasonable cause to engage in a separate competency evaluation when we have the same symptoms here. Now, I understand Mr. Frazier's position is that there's an obvious escalation in symptomology. I'm not sure that that's correct. I don't know that at any point the mental evaluation from the MCC was based on the number of individuals he's hearing or the content, right? I don't know that someone's more or less competent if the voices he's hearing says hi or you should hurt someone. That might affect his mental illness, but it doesn't affect his competency. And so when Judge Lichty hears that, he does go step by step and say, you know, where are these individuals in the courtroom you're hearing? Can you hear me? Can you tune everything out? And then he asks question after question to ensure that Mr. Frazier is in fact able to hear Judge Lichty and engage in a colloquy with him. That's what you want the court to do. What the court also did was it asked defense counsel, has anything changed? And as Judge Rovner pointed out, nothing had changed. Defense counsel said he has the same rational thought process as he did when he was previously sent for an evaluation. And so defense counsel, who this court heavily defers to because they are the individual that is engaging with the defendant on a regular basis, says nothing has changed. does not trigger any obligation for Judge Lichty to sua sponte, stop everything and say we need a new mental health evaluation. Finally, the court, I apologize, Your Honor.
At sentencing, the district court declared that idle hands can be evil hands. And that can prove true once again on supervision, because the unfortunate reality is you can't work because of your ongoing disability. And the court also declined to impose an assessment because his disability meant he did not have an earning capability. Isn't that language inconsistent with a supervised release requirement of full-time employment? And at a minimum, shouldn't we require the court to reconcile those apparently contradictory statements?
I don't think it is inconsistent, Your Honor. I think what the court was trying to get at is this defendant needs to do something, right? This defendant needs to not have idle hands, because when he commits the incident offense, he's on probation from his prior conviction, essentially in his bedroom trolling the internet and finding child pornography. Now, we have a much harder case if this is like Kappus or some of the other cases the defendant cites, where there is no backstop about community service and job skills training program. Reading the condition at paragraph 100 in the PSR, the backstop is absolutely in there. There's a work condition, and it says, if you are not employed, you must try to find full-time employment. If you become employed, you have to tell your probation officer. If after 90 days you do not find employment, you must complete at least 10 hours of community service per week until employed, or participate in a job skills training program approved and directed by your probation officer. So if the district court had said you need to work full-time, that's a tough argument for us on this record. The district court didn't say that. The district court said you need to work full-time, or if you can't do that, community service or job training.
So are you trying to reconcile what I believe to be contradiction by reading the supervised release condition as merely a requirement of 10 hours per week of community service? I mean, is there anything in the record indicating that this fellow, Fraser, who the district court noted had been disabled since 2001, would be capable of 10 hours per week community service?
I don't think there's anything in the record suggesting the defendant couldn't engage in 10 hours of community service. And because we are here on plain error standard of review, it's not plain and obvious he cannot engage in those 10 hours. And he's never argued that. He's never taken the position that he can't do 10 hours of community service or work training program. So it's not plainly and obvious erroneous to impose this condition as stated in paragraph 100 of the PSR.
So is what you're saying, Mr. Whalen, that no, the government is not going to hold him to employment if he can't work. He hasn't worked forever. But if he, we are going to hold him to the to at least trying the 10 hours of community service upon release, and if there's still an outlet if he can't do that, if his mental illness, you know, prevents him from doing that, he can file an application at that point in time to modify the supervised release and just terminate the condition altogether.
He could, Your Honor. The government's not going to hold him to anything. The probation department's going to hold him.
No, that's who I mean.
I apologize. But what the condition is saying is that he should work full time because he needs to have some pro-social behavior.
Right.
He needs to have some public protection. He needs to rehabilitate. And yes, if he is unable to find employment at that point, this condition provides a backstop.
Yeah, go do community service or job training.
Correct. And that's the type of condition that this court has affirmed prior in
And if there's a application to the court that he's violated a supervised release because he's not working, the parties will end up in front of the court and the district court judge will hash this out because he can say, I'm not working because I can't work.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, but I think a violation would have to occur if he can't work and then if he's not engaging in community service, if he's not engaging in the job skills. That's correct, Your Honor. Unless this court has any questions, one note about the condition itself. The defense says that the district court didn't adopt the reasoning in the PSR. That's not correct. On page 18 of the sentencing transcript, the district court says, your supervision will be governed by the recommended conditions for the reasons that are stated in that report as well as stated by the court today. So the court's adopting this italic part on paragraph 100 of the PSR that is additional support for its reasoning in imposing the condition. Unless this court has any questions about the condition of supervision or the competency evaluation, we would ask you affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.